Hi, everybody. Yep, we made it to Wednesday. Almost the end of February, and wow, there's a lot going on. We have a guest joining us in just a short while. We got the window seat today. We've got somebody from America talking to us about whether AI wouldn't make a better politician, a better president than actual people. And I know that immediately your reaction is like, whoa, hang on. But if it's AI, isn't it going to replace us and take our jobs? Well, yeah, in some people's cases, that wouldn't be a bad thing. In fact, if there's any theme to the last couple of days, it has got to be that taxpayers all over the world are being ripped off blind. So Elon Musk is now the head of DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency in America. I thought we'd start off hard today. Yep. He tweeted out and sent an email to every single person on the government payroll and said, do me a favor, just list in bullet point, you don't have to give any detail, five things you did in this week. Just five things. And it's caused such a shitstorm, you have no idea. It's like suddenly a whole bunch of people who thought they would be paid forever to do nothing are sitting around going, why do I have to prove that I'm accountable? Why do I have to prove that I'm doing anything useful and productive? Why do I have to prove that the U.S. taxpayer is paying me to do something when I thought I was just here because they were paying me? I mean, I know it sounds bizarre, right? And if you in your job this morning are listening to us, watching us, and you can't think of five things you've done, and it's only Wednesday, but if you can't think of five things you've done, you shouldn't have that job. But apparently, all over America, civil workers, people in the bureaucracy, are absolutely horrified that they have to account for themselves. And I wonder if we had to bring that here to South Africa. I wonder how many people in our civil service, which is already like the biggest part of our expense as a country, right? The most expensive thing in South Africa is that we have to pay for all these people who work in the government, and we're not sure what all of them do. Because every time you have anything to do with government, you're pretty much guaranteed that you're not going to get the service you want and that they are going to be doing a worse job than anybody else who's on the payroll in the private sector, for example. So I thought this is quite interesting. So someone in the American civil service has responded. Have you got that tweet of somebody like Elon says, give me five things you've done this week, and let me show you what kind of entitlement and wastage is going on. Then we'll bring it home. So here we go. hi, this is copied, by the way, to HR as well. So take a look at this quickly. I think this is an absolutely amazing revelation of what's really going on there. Wanted to email and tell you what I did last week in detail. Please let me know if you need more information. One, sucked the biggest dick. Seriously, it was 12.3 inches I measured. Two, got fucked by said dick. Best sex of my life. And we'll be going back for more. Three, ate a man's ass, but he said he wasn't gay, so it's fine. Four. There are only four here. Decided to fuck myself with your bullshit and came. Sincerely, go fuck yourself. So that's how a government employee responds to his boss when asked about five things he might have done that week. And Elon replies, ahem, we said five items. That's only four. So this guy's lucky that he at least has a sense of humor. But don't think that that's any different here in South Africa. I've got someone I follow on Instagram and on Twitter. His name is Kuketso. And he posted this, which I think is such an interesting thought, right? Because Business Tech are reporting that Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana has hit South Africa the blank reality check, or rather a bleak reality check. The tank is empty and we're out of easy options. They're basically warming us up for the idea that they're either going to increase VAT, which was the whole idea last week before they canceled his budget speech, by 2%, which will hit everybody right in the pocket and not in a good way. There's either that or they're going to raise an income tax, which, you know, income taxpayers are already responsible for about 60 to 70% of every cent that is brought in by the government and then redistributed and wasted and stolen. So they want to increase that because it's not good enough that you work for 6 months of the year, for the government. They think you should work for 7 or 8 months of the year for the government. And Koketso Rasani, who I follow on Twitter, said the following: "We did our part, government. We pay our taxes, we pay our municipal bills, we even pay our traffic fines. The tank is empty because of government ineptitude, poor policies, and cadres who use their political power to steal from the state." Correct. So even here in South Africa, what's going on in DOGE is starting to have ramifications because people are going, hang on, what are we paying for here? And I'm not kidding when I say that if you have a job, and I certainly hope that everyone listening to and watching this show has a job. If you don't, I'd rather you'd go on another show. But if you have a job, you are effectively working for the government for half the year. And that's embarrassing, for starters, but it's also unsustainable. So I really don't like any of this stuff I'm seeing. Just to prove the point, even in the private sector, there's huge wastage. There's a terrible host on MSNBC called Joy Reid. She's the one who's constantly race hustling and grifting. She's got a show called The Readout. It was canned last week because it had like 60,000 viewers a week. Remember, this is American cable television. These are people who are already paying a subscription for that channel. This woman couldn't scrape together 60,000 people watching in a week. So she was an unmitigated dumpster fire disaster of a host. Nobody liked her. She was absolutely appalling. She was a screeching banshee who would go off on tirades about all her political pet projects. And now she can't believe she's been fired. In fact, here's a little video, again, posted by somebody I follow who'll be on the left eating pancakes and pretending this is absolutely fine, because it is. And here's Joy Reid breaking down. She can't believe she's being held accountable. Like, you've actually got a job to do, Joy, and you didn't bring in any viewers or listeners. So take a look at this.
Had value, and that, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
That what I was doing had value. And in the end, I'm sorry, I try not to cry on TV. And this is kind of like me on TV, so I apologize. And then it mattered. I see Karen is there, and she's been texting me as well. And so what I will just say is that in the end, thank you. Where I land is that the moment that of guilt that I felt, that I went hard on so many issues, whether it was the Black Lives Matter issues of a young baby or a mom or a dad that was killed, or when we opened up people's eyes to the fact that...
The fact that she goes to, like, babies that... Where exactly in the whole Black Lives Matter thing was a baby killed? To my mind, she's just completely made that up. And then she goes into, like, Gaza and a whole bunch of other things. And I'm like, this woman is completely unhinged. So she is leaving. And everybody at MSNBC's hair is on fire, including Rachel Maddow, a 51-year-old man who looks like a woman. Well, woman who looks like a man. It's hard to figure it out. Anyway, the point is they're all very upset, and they say it's terribly racist because, you know, when Joy took her job there, she thought, oh, well, as a black woman, I'll be here forever. Bye. When you're shit, eventually the chickens will come home to roost. Eventually someone's going to say, why are we paying her again? So that's what's happened there. And speaking of wastage, I thought this was interesting too. USAID, which of course has closed its office in South Africa and all over the world, and we're hearing lots of people whining and moaning and gnashing their teeth over this as if it's the worst thing ever. Remember, this was not your money to start with. I hear people talking about clinics that are forced to close down and all kinds of other places that may have had a very, very important role to play in society, but this was never our money. We didn't have this money. It was American taxpayers' money. Just like you wouldn't want your money going to, the AU and their parliament, which they've set up in Midrand. Damn, that's right. It is going there. Damn. And what do we get for it? Oh, wait, nothing. So look at this. USAID in Haiti. Remember, Haiti's that disgraceful third world shithole in the middle of the Caribbean. Apparently, the U.S. sent $4.4 billion after the 2010 earthquake, yet less than 2% reached Haitians, while 56% lined the pockets of D.C. firms. This is happening all over the world, right? Just complete wastage and corruption. The Red Cross claimed to shelter 130,000 people, but they actually just built 6 homes. This is the beloved Red Cross that people talk about, being such a useful and brilliant organization who does so much good work. How do you, with a straight face, tell people we're sheltering 130,000 people and you end up building 6 homes? Did you think no one would ever find out? No transparency, no accountability. USAID and NGOs refuse to answer where the money went. Haitians are left with nothing. So, of course, the only people who lose at the end of this are the poor people who were meant to be the ones who got the money in the first place. And then, just to top this off, and then I promise I will move on. I do want to have a happy Wednesday, but this has been on my mind, as I'm sure it's on yours. Apparently, George Soros and the Open Society Foundation, our former ambassador here, eventually went to work for the Open Society Foundation as their CEO, the former American ambassador to South Africa. Apparently, they received $260 million from USAID. He didn't even spend his own money to destroy the American judicial system. He used their money. This is how this network of unbelievable grift and corruption works. And anybody who thinks that that's worth defending, hey, at least they're doing you the favor of telling you who their enemies are. So I don't know what the Minister of Finance is going to announce this week or whether he'll actually be able to announce anything, but I think he's getting awfully close to a point where South African taxpayers are going to go, we don't want to give you any more. We don't have any more. Anyone who can get out, get out. And the rest of you, just keep paying until the squeeze is applied so much that there's nothing left to squeeze. So he's got to realize also in every country you reach a threshold. I mean, with the American Revolution, it was 2% on tea. It was 2% in Boston Harbor that the British government in London was going to exact a toll on in America. The Americans, who don't even really drink tea, I suppose maybe coffee hadn't become a thing yet. But a bunch of people in Boston decided, no, we will not pay 2% more on tea. And they threw all the tea off the ships into the harbor. And that was the start of the American Revolution. We know how that went for Britain, right? So just a friendly warning to anybody who's in government at the moment and thinks that they can keep on taking, delivering nothing, and raising the taxes. Eventually, you reach a breaking point. All right, enough of that. We'll get to some more news and the rest of it in just a short while. Had to start off this morning with some kind of a rant, right? And we're joined this morning by Justin Stradom. Now, we were talking to Caleb last week, and he told us that we have to meet you. Wow. And that you're a fascinating guy. And I mean, just looking at what you've done and what you've been up to and, you know, your IMDb page, for example. I mean, there's so much to talk to you about. Nice to have you here. Sorry you had to sit through my rant about taxes, but I don't feel that you're opposed.
No, I'm definitely not opposed. Definitely not. You know, it's crazy because we experience it, funny enough, in the entertainment industry.
More than almost anybody, right? Because you're public facing, and so they want to make an example of anyone who doesn't do what they meant to do with taxes.
Well,
but they also charge you guys. There are agents involved. There are castings that you have to go to. Yeah. There are all these other things that build up. And then you get paid this instead of that.
Yeah. So the funny thing is, and it's on both sides. So as an actor, I get whether I earn 50 cents for the month or 100,000 rand, whatever it is, I'll get
the same
25%.
That's
what we get nailed. And then your agent's fees and everything come on top of
that. So you're telling me even in a month where you might not be working, despite the fact that you might have had 3 or 4 good months before that, yeah. And that means you have to financially plan like nobody else, right?
Absolutely. And you're talking about people that make a living out of acting like a child. and then there's another aspect to it. And I mean, this is stuff that I've experienced. We did a feature film with the Department of Trade and Industry.
Okay.
Which was initially set up. There's a film fund that's set up to help filmmakers because making films in South Africa is complicated, is expensive, and it's not profitable.
Yeah.
But we need to do it. There needs to be some record of who we are as a people.
Right.
There are companies, and I mean, this is bad press for the DTI. I don't mind.
Well, they're the same people who promised they would look after artists.
Yes.
During COVID.
And you know that there are producers that have been waiting 5, 6, 7 years for money that's owed to them.
you know, you can't run a business, certainly, but well, you can't even survive.
Well, the problem is and this is always the issue. I mean, this happened to me personally. I was working with a production, and it's been a couple of productions, and I know that Saga are talking about it a lot now, where this is taxpayers' money, essentially, that has been allocated. It's not like there isn't money or there wasn't money planned for this.
Yeah.
But these producers go out, they employ a lot of people, and then come the end of the production, they cannot pay people. And it's incredible because you incur expenses. It's not like a known expense. You know, you've got to drive to work. So you'll get into your car and you'll drive out whatever money you have left just to get to the gig, believing that you'll get paid at the end of the month. So it's a very complicated, and I don't think our politicians and our bureaucrats and some of the private sector actually realize the sacrifice that the average person makes just to get to work, you know, just to stay in the game. I think it's kind of cruel, you know. People talk about it on like a really top level, but I think they miss out.
You're right. And this is they just scrape off the top. They don't care about what's happening underneath, right? Whether the company isn't going to say, okay, well, in that case, we'll just lay off these people.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, in any kind of business, not just in acting like yours. But I was looking at this IMDb profile of yours. I mean, you've done some amazing stuff. You were obviously in District 9, which I loved.
Which was a blast.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, geez, it was fun.
Yeah?
And it wasn't meant to be like that. You know, I remember getting the brief for this strange little film called District 9.
Where did they film it?
Oh, all over. We were in Soweto mostly.
Uh-huh.
Skyline of Johannesburg. I spent a lot of time. I probably spent more time firing rounds off and in the air in a helicopter in those 3 months that we filmed that I did in my entire military career as a special weapons instructor.
You're a special weapons instructor?
Yes, yeah.
Listen, you and I are going to talk about that more than we will about acting, if that's okay with you.
We can talk about whatever you want.
So you did District 9, which obviously was and by the way, what a smart idea for a movie, right?
Oh, it was great.
What a clever movie.
Yeah, from the short film all the way through to, I mean, when they started off that Neil Blomkamp, when him and Sholto Copley did that little YouTube short film in the hope that somebody would watch it and fund it. And then to get picked up by Peter Jackson,
wild.
That's not a bad catch, yeah.
So you've been in 480 episodes, it says, of Deepa Vartas, which is a hugely successful series.
500, actually.
Wow, okay, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Congrats.
Week, yeah.
So 500 episodes. Do they do like a celebration on set? For that,
we get a jersey. We get like a little hoodie.
Like, come on, guys.
Oh no, look, it's I must say that Deepa Vartas is Caleb's actually, that's where I met Caleb.
That's
from.
Right. Yeah, and he said to me, we had him here last Wednesday. He's like, you've got to talk to this Justin. He's just the most awesome guy. So apart from this very impressive CV, which really, I mean, it's hard in acting in South Africa.
Yeah.
And to have as much work and as much consistent work as you've had, you've got to be really good because things are so fickle. They change on a dime. It's a very tough business. Do you have people coming up to you, especially young people, and saying, how do I become an actor? And how do I become a successful actor? And how do I make this my living? Because there's no answer.
Well, you know, the reality is, I think I was, I'm going to use the word privileged, and I don't mind
using
it.
It's such a dangerous word.
It's such a dangerous word, but I certainly was. You know, I didn't have a middle class. My mom, who eventually took care of me on her own, did the absolute best she could with what she had. But I wasn't used to material privilege. And so when I use the word privilege, I learned very early on how to get by on very little. So cars weren't important. They still aren't important. A big fancy house was never important, just a roof over the head. It still isn't important. Telling a story, telling my story, or telling other people's stories was primary.
Right.
And my mom had the humor to boot with it, and no matter what life threw at her, she could cope with that. So, you know, making it as an actor, I suppose it depends what making it means. You know, I've done way more, by the way, than what my IMDb shows. I've done.
Oh, is the stuff that they leave out?
Oh, they don't. They don't get to nearly half the stuff. I mean, I've done way more than that. And certainly some.
I mean,
are
you talking about the writing and producing stuff as well?
What about acting also? Stuff that never makes it. The short films that we do.
Do you have to tell them what you're doing? Because I thought IMDb employed like a staff of people who kept records.
I think they do. I think they absolutely do. And I think they do the best they can with the information they get. But certainly there's. I mean, one of the first films that I did was. I don't know if you remember Uncle Paul's Untold Tales.
I remember Barney Simon used to do something called Uncle Paul's Story, Bedtime Story.
Exactly.
Which was a thing on the radio when I was a kid, and it was one of the absolute highlights of everybody's week.
Yeah. So it was kind of like horror stories and all of that.
Wow. Did you produce a...
So no, I was an actor in one of the first film spinoffs.
No.
Of that. Yeah, She Loves You to Death was the one that I acted in. So it doesn't find it.
Wow.
Well, thank goodness, because it was...
Was it bad?
Wow. You know, it's a typical, it was like, we didn't have B-grade horrors. It was a nasty horror. It was cheap and nasty, but what an absolute jaw I had doing it. It was crazy. We filmed most of it in Midrand, which was supposed to be the Lesotho Highlands. And, I think we were all swimming in the Yuxke River, which...
Wow.
But look, back then when I first filmed then it was
now
really
you would
not bad.
Die of
now
several I think, different diseases.
Listen, I've swum in the Yuxke a lot as an actor. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I suppose it for a long time, it's the only flowing water that we have.
Well, the Vaal. I've gone to the Vaal, but I'm not convinced I'd swim in the Vaal right now.
I would not use any of our waterways, frankly. No. I think they're all polluted as hell.
Yeah.
And we're not looking after them, but that's a whole discussion
for
another day.
They're pretty to look at still.
So before we move off of the acting stuff, because I do think that this is, it's probably, let's save you some trouble and some time. The thing that you get asked about, how do I become an actor? Mm. What is your usual response to people? Because you don't want to shatter people's dreams. And who knows that you don't meet some kid who's just extraordinarily talented. I saw old Timothy Chalamet at the Screen Actors Guild yesterday. Saying, and people were talking about this online, he was saying, maybe this is my first step to really becoming one of the greats. And he was very humble and nice about it, but he's setting a lofty goal. He talked about Marlon Brando and Al Pacino and those sort of people. That is stratospheric success, and some would say he's already reached levels of unprecedented success for an industry that's harder now than ever. No. You don't have big Hollywood the way that it was in the 50s, 60s, 70s. You don't have box office heroes with the exception of maybe Tom Cruise, And filmmaking has become a net loss business for so many movies and for so many directors and producers. So what do you say to these kids?
Well, I always try and I shifted away from acting per se and more to storytelling. And tell them that is you develop that desire over time, and depending on how you would like to share stories and the medium that you choose to share them in becomes a personal choice. So, you know, we've never had a Hollywood in South Africa. We've just had actors that operate on stage or on television, or if they're incredibly lucky, they'll get to do film. And when people ask me if they want to become actors, I usually my first response is you need to study. You absolutely need to. And I know it's very counter what a lot of people suggest nowadays that you shouldn't study. But one of the difficult things you will find as an actor is a group of like-minded people that will buy into this idea of playfulness because that's essentially what you do. You know, mostly when you get out of school, people will tell you, you've got to get a job. It's a completely different way of thinking. It's this passion to tell stories.
Yeah, if I had a kid who wanted to go into acting, I'd send them straight back to the orphanage. I mean, it's just not it's no way. I'm not supporting you until you're 50 years old. It's not going to happen. Go and get a job. Go work in the mines for all I care, but you're not going to become an actor.
There's a story there. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the acting's, people don't make money, but you make money. It's incredible. I used to lecture at AFTA, which is incredibly.
That's a very, very good school.
It's absolutely. Sure. And I would tell people, you know, if you're going to invest in something, give yourself just a chance. As an actor, give yourself a chance. Go to a film school because theatre is a real challenge in our country. It really is tough.
Yeah, that's that.
It's a whole different ball game. So if they ask me, I'll tell them, find a way, scrape together money, make an investment in this, and go and give yourself at least a year.
Yeah.
Go and hang out and see whether or not you're actually, because one thing that happens at Afton, and people try to make it political. They try to make it, they try to swing a victim narrative, like if only people can see how good I am. The reality is you're going to be working with people roughly your age that should love you, should want to put you on screen. And if you can't do that in your first year, if you can't encourage people to put you on screen in your first year, forget about doing it as a career. Really don't do that to yourself, because when you do a job, it's really about your skills and your ability to do whatever you have to do. As acting, it's not just your skill. It's the way you look, the personality you have. And often people will walk away going, why can't I get employed? Is it because I'm not good enough? And that's a tough place to exist.
I mean, that is always one of the hardest things in the entertainment business, is you're only as good as your last project, right?
Absolutely.
I know you were also involved. You were a writer on that Riva Steenkamp.
Yeah, I was the story producer on it.
Okay. So, yeah. I mean, that must have also got a lot of international attention because it was such a big story. We always tend to think it's just very South African, but everyone all over the world was paying attention to that.
Yeah, we shaped that story specifically for an international audience because there just isn't money, you know. Yeah. The guy that the producer behind it, Warren Batchelor, who his brother Mark was pretty notorious, and that was
I remember.
Yeah, so that was my into that world, because it's tough. You know, people think that you can just sit down and write a story about Oscar or about Riva, and one of the challenges we had is how do we tell that story, because everybody knows what it was about. You know, there's nothing. Oscar got sentenced for murder, so there's no wow, great big surprise.
There's no like big revelation, apart from the fact that he's not allowed to write a book because he can't benefit from the proceeds of a crime.
Yes.
Someone even said in the comments here on the show the other day, they were like, well, why don't you interview him? What is there to say? Like, the whole thing was discussed in minute detail. Do you remember, like, what angle the bullets went through the door? And how much more must we drag out of this story? People seem to think that crime and investigation is a bottomless pit.
Yeah.
You can keep going. And you can see it leads to conspiracy theories like the JFK assassination. I mean, they've released all the files now.
Yeah.
And there's no big multi-part documentary series about all the hidden agents and how, because there aren't any, right? Yeah. It's actually a way simpler story than people think it is. But to take a story like that and then to make it interesting to an international audience, to tell enough about the background, to give them a flavor of what happens in South Africa. We've got a big domestic violence problem. We've got, you know, celebrities. We've got loads of things to talk about that are very niched and very South African.
Yeah.
But you've got to find the things, I suppose, when you're putting together the stuff that you were, that will appeal to an international audience.
Absolutely.
Too.
You know, I remember Warren and I used to argue, because it took him about 6 years to get the money for this. Six years of incredibly hard work.
Wow.
And him, he was very close. He became, over that period of time, he became very close to Reva's parents, Barry and June.
Mm.
And a lot of promises I made. I mean, doing a documentary is tough, especially about crime stories, because there are victims, and the reality is their circumstance doesn't change. There's nothing you can do, as much as you wanted to. I mean, we set little goals for ourselves. With My Name is Riva, you know, Oscar had the potential to come out a little early, you know, and we were like, that's not going to happen. That's not right. There are all sorts of rules, so we pushed really hard, and I think in some ways we created enough. I don't want to call it heat, but we certainly created enough
interest
that he didn't get out a day earlier than what he was supposed to. You know, he served his full time, and there's small little victories, but it doesn't change the fact that Oscar went out with a beautiful woman for 3 months and she wound up
dead.
And you can't. Those are the facts. You know, there are interesting things that we were never, you know, we were, when we did the story, because we did it in conjunction with Mnet, it was very interesting for me. I remember putting out our first episode and then getting a response from Mnet's attorneys, Weber Wenzel.
Mm.
Wow. Wow, the stuff that we had to...
Redact.
Redact. Is that a sweet word? That's a sweet word.
It's a lawyer word.
That's a sweet word. And I mean, we our intention was to be a lot more aggressive, to highlight some of the obvious things that people don't want to discuss. I mean, that's as a storyteller, and we shouldn't have carte blanche, but I really do think that we should be allowed to explore things in a little more candidly, you know, than...
Tell me about the shittiest thing you've had to do as an actor. You mentioned Swimming in the Yuck Scam, and that's got to be right up there. But, you know, there are a lot of these movies or TV series that you've been involved in where I'm sure they ask you to do something, and you're like, not a chance. I mean, sometimes, you know, the producers will ask me, what about getting this person? And I'll be, I don't want to talk to that person. But that's about as difficult as it gets.
Yeah.
How about you? I mean, it must be some things they've asked you to do.
Look, there's, you know, all films deal with sex, politics, and religion, and then a little something in between.
And does any of that bleed out, by the way, into your real life?
It does. It does.
So you're playing a character. Because also, I always remember talking to, I think it was Sophie Ndaba back in the day about her role as queen on Generations, which was iconic. But then she'd meet people on the street who would say, like, they thought they were talking to Queen. They'd bring up stuff from the storyline that was not relevant to Sophie at all, that she'd forgotten, frankly. It was like 10, 20 seasons ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And people are like, you know, you've got a problem. Do you still have that even with shows like Deep of Artists now in the 2020s?
Yeah.
Are people still like a bit doff about those things? They don't know how to draw the line between the actor and the role?
Well, I do think, and I think this is where reality gets a little bit skewed. I'm in their living room every single night, four nights a week. So they do
And
develop-
for some of these lonely, sad, pathetic individuals, you're the only person that they can see.
I also, they think they know you. I think there's a familiarity. You know, I've done a show, I was doing a stage play, where I'll start off at Dinner for One, which is a good old classical piece with a staunch British accent and falling around and stumbling around over the lion's head, which we all know. We all know that story well, but I'll walk on. It'll be in English, and somebody will shout out from the audience, which is very inappropriate. I mean, it's supposed to be quiet. There's supposed to be this almost religious experience, and I'll have somebody shout out, "Hey, Gijs, wat maak
je?" Right, well, Gijs is, of course, your role in Deep of Artists.
Exactly, and I'm like, wow, okay, now we've all got to pull ourselves back around to the character that I'm playing now. But generally speaking, I must say, people are generally amazing.
Okay.
And I've never had...
I'm sorry to hear that. I was hoping you would admonish them
from the pulpit. No, I can't. I can't because you know, it's so beautiful. I live in Parys now, which is this tiny little free state town, not far from Johannesburg, but it really is a tiny little town. It's a good example of where South Africa could go, or Johannesburg could go, if we don't pull ourselves together very quickly.
Well, yes and no, because Parys is in way better condition than most of our small towns. I mean, so many of our small towns are completely falling apart. Is it also a disaster?
No, it's if you take a drive around, I mean, there's not a road in the town itself that is functional. Not really. It's filled with potholes.
So it's also
and I mean, the main arterial road coming into Parys is a disaster. You right now, I mean, I counted 136 potholes.
Oh my God!
Serious potholes.
Thank you for coming in this morning. I didn't realize it was such an ordeal. Normally, I think that people are just coming from somewhere here in Joburg.
No. It was an absolute pleasure. I mean, that's the road I do. I've worked mostly in Johannesburg, but there are definite challenges. But anyway, I was sitting there having a waffle or something in one of the little beautiful little shops there, and this woman with an older child, so she must have been in her 50s, and he must have been in his 30s. So you know, and they walked over, and he was very shy and very well mannered, as most Afrikaans viewers are. They, you know,
yeah, sure.
And
goeie maniere.
And she didn't want to bother me. She really, but she couldn't help herself. Sure. She just had to. Quickly, I know you're in the middle of your meal, but I just have to say something. And she just said, basically, thank you.
Hmm.
Thank you very much. And I don't think you realize what it means. And that's a strange thing. It's you kind of look at that, and I wanted to engage, what do you mean, what it means? And I think often what we forget is that there are people that are invisible. They struggle to see their reality or their world reflected in any way. You know, everything's so polarizing and so aggressive and so hateful that people don't necessarily ever catch their breath. And then along comes a series like Dipavatars. And it gives people a moment to laugh at somebody that they're familiar with, somebody that they recall from their childhood or whatever it might be.
Well, you said something so true just now, is that you're inside of people's living rooms every night, and there's a responsibility to that too.
Absolutely.
You know, I often used to think about the fact that people would be driving into work in the mornings listening to or watching us. And you have the opportunity there to make their day great or to make it absolutely shit. And I hope we do the former more than we do the latter, but I can't guarantee anything. Carl DeSantos says, please don't mention MNET's lawyers. Gareth has PTSD. No, I don't. I won, remember? I won. I beat that team of lawyers. Can Neanderthals surely say any word they want, right? Says Mo Rabbit. Oh, this has turned into such a thing. Huge Erection says, does this actor have any specific conditions when on a movie set, like any riders? Do you have...
I've got a story.
Have you got like I only want the blue M&Ms. Have you ever had that kind of level of where you could be a J-Lo?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Look, you know, that's one of the most difficult things. Those intimate scenes that we film are probably the most difficult. And it's changed over the years. I used to love it. You know, when I first started, I remember the first kiss I had to do on screen. I had no idea how to do it. And it was this young girl that had never studied acting. It was on a soapy.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea how to go about it. But I knew she was excited. And I was kind of like awkward because it's a kiss, you know?
Sure. And yeah, that's a big moment.
I went to Darren Kalfkin. He played Joe in Egoli all these years.
Oh, wow.
Years
okay, ago. So yes.
It
okay.
was a long time
yes,
ago.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I was like, I don't know how to do this. And he went, listen, Justin. Kiss her like you must kiss her that she feels in here, right in the bottom of her spine. So push through, give it everything you've got, don't let her catch her breath.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I'm gonna give this a bash. So we started kissing, and in those days we had run a play, so you could see what was happening on the floor at various television spots. Anyway, I went in for the kiss and we both went for it, and I remember hearing the cut. And as we pulled away from each other, she hadn't really breathed at all through the kiss. So she came out and she was like that, and she fell backwards. And I heard this laughter coming out from everywhere. Obviously, we had to go for another take because you're not supposed to suck the life out of somebody. When you,
like a vampire.
Like a vampire when you kiss them. But that was certainly, and that was the way. I really enjoyed the fact that it was, we were both quite awkward about doing this because it wasn't somebody. And I really enjoyed that. Now you've got a lot of, you've got to be very careful. You've got intimacy coordinators and it makes it quite, you know.
Just tell me what an intimacy coordinator is meant to do. Like what, are these fully employed people? We talk about government wastage when I started the show this morning, but surely an intimacy coordinator is not even necessary for half the episodes that you're filming of a specific show.
So we don't have, on soapies, we have very frank, very open conversations. I do that. I mean, I'm in a storyline now where I am courting three women at the same time. And it's a bit messy. It's a bit, but what I love is that there's a certain level of respect. We can sit down, we can have a conversation. Yes, we are involved in intimate scenes. But generally speaking, I find that people can have, as long as there's a level of respect, you can have this conversation. Our intimacy coordinators are there because, and I've seen it. I've seen it. I've witnessed some nasty stuff happen on set.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes, you know, sometimes, and I don't want to mention names. I don't think, it's the right space to name and shame. But especially with younger actresses, I've seen things get completely out of hand.
You mean that the guys take advantage?
Absolutely.
And that's on a set where there are people around all the
time. Absolutely, and it's small things. It's small things, you know, because when you film, there's so much that has happened before those cameras that start rolling, you know. And when those cameras start rolling, you've got to sit in the moment or whatever it is, regardless of what has just happened. but in the rehearsals, in the quiet moments in the green room where people are sitting and talking, and also because you now have this intimate relationship, some lines are crossed.
Well, you know what I think the problem is there is that they make you guys wait so much between. No, I mean, if you didn't have so much time,
they would have on trailers. It would be fantastic.
But that's also why when you see the famous example of like Brad and Angelina on Mr. and Mrs. Smith, right? It was bound to happen. You got these two people who are good looking. They're being every whim, every need is being catered to.
Absolutely.
They don't have to worry about food. They've got a trailer they're staying in. And by the way, when we talk about trailers, Hollywood style, it's like a palace in there.
Oh, no, it's incredible.
And they're around each other all the time. And there's hurry up and wait. They got to change the lighting on this. So you've got the whole afternoon off. What are you going to do? You're stuck in the middle of nowhere on a set. They end up spending an inordinate amount of time with each other. And then everybody goes, I can't believe they fell in love on the set. It must happen way more than people think.
Well, I think absolutely it happens to me. And I think I think the obvious thing is when I kiss somebody, I spend some time with a person in an intimate situation. I might be going, I'm acting in my head, but my body's going like, oh no, this is for real. And sometimes,
yeah,
you know, you're in a situation with somebody that is extraordinarily attractive. I've never really acted with anybody that I don't go, whoa.
Well,
she's beautiful.
I mean, an ugly actress has got a very tough time ahead of her, right?
I've never really worked with anybody that I haven't been attracted to on some level.
But you also, as an actor, it's your job to find that one thing that's attractive about
absolutely.
Someone.
Absolutely. You're pushing. So, and by the time the cameras start rolling, everything's so heightened. It is a hyper reality that you exist in. You are feeling those things, and I challenge anybody not to feel that. I think you'll come across
fall in love at work, man.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, in boring, like, fucking accountants hook up at the coffee machine. Yeah,
absolutely.
Sarah and Jonathan meet up at the coffee machine and they're like, sir, how was your day? Did your balance sheet end up, how was your ledger?
And yes, another truth. There's a moment.
And then they're like, ooh, you look hot.
But that,
did you say ledger? Fuck.
But you know what it also is if you give somebody just a moment, just a chance to share a little bit of their story and you buy into it, just a little bit. So you'll sit down and you go like, you know, so how are things going with you?
Yeah.
No, I'm good.
They take
really?
The,
are
they
you
take
really
that.
Good? And they go, no, I'm really having a tough time at home or whatever the case is.
Oh, ooh. God. You see, this is why I don't.
But that's at you, the moment you slip into that space.
I don't ever let them get that because I don't want to hear. I'm just frankly not interested. You kind of have to if it's someone you're working with.
Absolutely.
Because if you don't have a connection,
you're
never going to be able to act it convincingly, certainly if you're a real actor.
It's horrible if you don't. It's horrible.
Yeah, I don't want to know anybody's shit. The moment someone starts.
But you're wrapped up in everybody's shit.
No, I don't involve my. Dude, it's so easy
I've
to be.
I've heard your rant this morning.
Yes, but I'm. That's a very objective, very sterile discussion of stuff that's going on that's empirical mostly. I'm not talking about how sad and upset or how happy and elated or, you know, you guys in acting, you're way better at this emotional stuff than I am. I couldn't care less.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just not interested when people use words like feel more than they use words like think.
Mm.
Then normally, 8 out of 10 times, they're not my people.
Sure. That's interesting because I do think it's interesting because Antonio Damasio, I don't know if you know him, he's a neuroscientist, and it's very interesting. He pushed studies, and now obviously I went into a lot of that because whenever I write, and I'm particularly interested in psychopaths and sociopaths and people that do things that are on the peripherals, people that have the capacity to do extreme things.
Are you hinting at something here?
Yeah. Well, I'm not hinting just yet. But
I'm not offended. Go on.
But what I did find very interesting in his research. Because the logical mind is incredible. It just sees things in black and white. It really is just what it is. And he did this one interesting, and I remember reading this thing a couple of times, like going, is this possible? But he interviewed multiple psychopaths, which in itself is rare because you don't just walk down the road and find a psychopath. It's roughly 1% of the world's population.
And they're not really the people you want to spend time with. So this guy put his...
Well, I think psychopaths, generally speaking, out of the 1% that exists in the world today that carry that Viking gene or whatever, because they're born that way. They don't
berserker.
They're born that way. What is interesting about them is that of the 1% that are in society, only about, I think, 1% of them kill. So it's so okay, your
one,
chances.
So 1% of the 1% kill.
Yeah, so your chances of bumping into
and the rest won't become hugely successful CEOs of Tesla.
Absolutely. Well, we went there, but the reality is that psychopaths have this inane capacity to. Well, it's not that they don't feel or that they have to force themselves not to feel. It's these guys are genuinely don't. Like he did this experiment, this Antonio Damasio did an experiment with one of the psychopaths where he would ask him randomly what time of day it was. And the psychopath couldn't tell him.
What?
Couldn't tell him at all.
Really?
We can roughly do that because we kind of like, oh shit, it's almost lunchtime. So I'm feeling kind of hungry now. And
but a proper psychopath doesn't have any training wheels.
They don't feel that because it's not important. It's right now I'm having a conversation with you. You're interviewing me and I'm hyper fixated in that moment. And yeah. I'm really finding this.
You're paying attention.
Yeah. But not just attention because, you know, you and I have got a lot of social cues that we're feeding off and emotional cues, whether we like it or not, because there's this idea that, geez, if I'm going to have a conversation with somebody, surely they got to like me just a little bit. And even if they say, no, I really don't care whether you like me or not, right. It's not entirely true. We all play that game. And psychopaths, they fixate on something, and I find that remarkably interesting. So when you say that you don't care about all that emotional stuff,
I think not at all. Yeah. I mean, I don't think I'm even on the spectrum of that kind of
you're not capable of
unfeeling. I'm close. I'm close. I'll admit that. All right. I want you to hang with us for a little bit longer if you're okay with
that.
No,
absolutely.
You come all the way from Paris. So yeah,
I'll hang around.
So it's time for us to check out a little bit of travel this morning. And we're going to talk about travel.co.za. We do this every 2 weeks. We get to go to an interesting place. Talk to someone who knows a lot about how the travel business works, because God knows if you don't have an expert on your side when it comes to these things, you won't have the greatest time off. And let's face it, most people work a lot so they can have a little bit of holiday. We're going to speak to Janine Abrahams, who is the general manager of Associations and Congresses at TourVest. So she knows her stuff, and an accredited professional conference organizer, among other things. The Associations and Congresses unit is an agency within TourVest. They deal with meetings, incentives, conferences, and events. So a lot of corporate travel there. And I thought it'd be interesting, especially because we're at the start of the year, budgets are being discussed, whether they're national budgets or company budgets. And maybe if you are the sort of person who is in charge of those budgets, this will be an interesting conversation to be a part of. So good morning, Janine.
Morning, Dennis. How are you?
Nice to see you. Good.
Nice to see you too.
You're up bright and early to help us understand what's going on in the world of corporate travel and all these amazing things. I mean, there are big companies in South Africa that spend a lot of money on congresses, conferences, events, incentives. Tell us how all of that works and what kinds of budgets are involved, which companies seem to be, I mean, you don't have to mention them by name, but are companies spending more or less on this stuff now?
So, guys, with us is we focus a lot on your larger sort of conferences, anything between sort of 300 to 15,000 participants.
Wow.
And usually these conferences, they rotate around the world. They normally have a cycle where they come back every 10 to 15 years. So we generally work with your local association, even though there is an international party.
Right.
We work with your local host to market the conference, and not just within South Africa, but around the world. So for one conference, we might end up in 10 different cities. Sure. Just to market the conference, to make people aware, to promote our beautiful attractions, and also to remind people and to address negative perceptions. Because believe it or not, people out there, they have a lot of negative perceptions about our city and about our beautiful country, and they don't always know what we have to offer. So it's really just to entice them, to ensure that we increase those delegate numbers, because the more people we can get into the city, the better for our economy.
Sure.
So for us, in terms of large volumes, that is our focus, and to make sure that everyone, not just within South Africa and within Africa, but around the world, come and see our beautiful country.
Janine, how difficult is it to coordinate anything with 400 to 15,000 people? I mean, 400, I think, for most of us, you know, if you've been to a big wedding is 400, but 15,000 people. So when you see these big conference centers in Joburg, Cape Town, Durban, I know they've got the G20 coming to Durban now. So when you have those big numbers, what are the most difficult things that you have to get working in order to manage numbers of that size?
That's the very first thing, Gareth, is to start with the project timeline. I mean, we cannot start with any event without a clear timeline defining the roles and responsibilities. You still have to prepare all the logistics, whether you've got 10 participants or 15,000. So for us, it's important that you've got a proper timeline in place, that everyone understands their roles and responsibilities, and of course the budget. Because without your participants, because it's usually self-funded, you know, a large amount of the spending comes from delegate income.
And tell me quickly about managing events across the rest of Africa, because obviously many of these companies are locally based and they will want to organize incentive trips across the rest of the continent, across the rest of the world. Do you guys manage that as well?
Yes, we do. So not only within South Africa, but also within Africa. We've recently just done a conference in Rwanda. We've done in Ethiopia. We're now looking at next year, Marrakesh. So our focus is not only to be a PCO or a professional conference organizer within South Africa, but also within Africa.
And sustainability is obviously a big thing here, because that's the buzzword in corporate South Africa and all
absolutely,
over the world.
Absolutely.
So what does that mean, though? I mean, what does it mean to you? What are the kinds of things they expect you to do in order to tick the box for sustainability?
I think the focus, again, has shifted to sustainability, to sustainable events, and, of course, to minimize the environmental impact and promoting social responsibility. So on our side, with every proposal, you know, it's a requirement. So we look at eco-friendly materials, you know, the exhibition booths that we set up, the venues who prioritize sustainability. We look at waste management, looking at things like digital programs rather than printing programs and notebooks, and also, using sustainable materials. So we constantly need to look at sustainable tourism culture.
All right, that's fantastic. So if there are people listening now who'd like to organize any of these things, you're the right person to talk to.
Absolutely. So, awesome. For all our conferences. So we offer advanced technology. We can manage your flights, your transfers. We've got a dedicated team that's experienced. So
amazing.
I'm right, the person to talk to.
Well, then that's the person to speak to, is Janine Abrahams at Tourvest. So very nice to have you on the show this morning. And of course, you can also You can also check out all the amazing tourist destinations all over the world. If you're thinking of planning a holiday, I actually booked something in the end of January for December. I was like, I'm not going to be caught. Again, getting to the end of the year, people go, what are you doing in December? And then it's like the first. And I'm not doing anything. You end up spending more. You end up going to places you don't want to go. Or you just sit at home and you go, oh, I'm feeling sorry for myself because I didn't have a holiday. So I did it in January. And you can do that too. Go along to travel.co.za and make your dream holiday a reality. We've got Justin Stratum in the studio with us this morning. And we're talking about all kinds of amazing things. I mean, we've bounced around a lot. You told me psychopaths and actors, but I repeat myself, and so much more. So Carl DeSanta says, how much leftover food do you think there is after the lunch at the Ethiopian event?
It's a little bit odd. I mean, do they still have a problem there?
No, we were raised on that shit.
I remember. Oh, yeah.
Anytime I didn't eat my food.
All those inappropriate jokes.
I'm just talking about the guilt trip my mother would put me on.
Oh, absolutely.
If we didn't eat our supper, because maybe it was not what we were in the mood for that night. Do you know there are children in Ethiopia who are starving? And I saw a comedian the other day who got up on stage and he's fat. He goes, well, Africa, how do you feel about what you've done to me? You kept telling me that I wasn't eating the food because the starving Africans. He goes, look at me now. I hope you feel bad.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
There's not much more you can say to that, but I.
Then don't. I don't want you to get into trouble.
Comment on that.
Oh, man. All right. So let's just quickly look at a couple of these comments here before we get to some more fun stuff after 7. Okay. Shrooms will take you to an interesting place, says Barely Vocal Media. Wow, some people are really getting straight into that first thing in the morning. there's a lot of conversation about this going on.
Oh.
Yeah. CNN ads traumatized us about that too, says Khomotso. Yeah, you remember they used to play those ads of like, CNN, this is CNN, and then they pan to like vultures sitting right next to
James
children.
James Earl Jones's warm voice.
Yeah.
And cut to the kid standing there, and he's got what, a distended stomach and no food.
Kwashiorkor's disease or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Do you have to, when you're in a particular role, and this is a very serious question that I actually think we should do after seven, because it's something that I think you, among a very small handful of actors, are responsible for. We have a country where we have terrible male role models in general. Mm. Do you ever feel that your characters, because it's easy to beat up on the dad. You know, dads are mostly the idiots in sitcoms. Dads are never the strong guys that they should be in society. In most productions, they're trying to push this girl boss thing as well. But we've got a problem in South Africa because so many young men don't have a male role model to look up to. And when you're on TV or you're in a movie as a South African man or as a man just generally, you can only do so much with a script if you're the actor. But if you have some input and you can put out a positive role model instead of a shitty role model, do you think that's important in this country?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
Absolutely,
huh?
It's a big deal. It's a big deal, and I think the biggest fights I have on set, and they're never personal, they're always creative. With the directors, and they humor me a huge amount, is we get these parts where I go, well, this is just terrible. We can say it amongst us. We just look at each other and go, okay, this is absolutely
really?
Terrible. Why is he doing this? And it's very frustrating because we still have to shoot 20 odd pages in a day. So when I come in, I want to flatten 17 or 18 pages in a day. It's incredibly exhausting for people. But I must say that I do find that we can put them. Not that Gijs is a fantastic role model, but in many ways, we try and at least give a balanced perspective. You know, if you're going to have a strong protagonist, you need a bloody strong antagonist. They need to, and if you don't have that, then you make everybody weak around them. And that for me is the tragedy of making men weak, is that in doing that, you make everyone weak. You make every woman that has done amazing things. You know, I grew up, and this is astounding thing for me, is everybody thinks that women only started getting strong with the women's rights movement, which is the strongest women I've known.
Can you imagine being a wife in the medieval era? Your husband goes off to fight Saladin in the Holy Land, and suddenly every horrible man that's left behind, all these weak, horrible, nasty men, it's like suddenly standing around
exactly.
Like this. And I mean, it's just
prospects.
Terrible, right?
Yeah,
those
women
had to be tougher than nails.
Absolutely. But even our generation growing up with moms that had to work.
Sure.
They had to work and they had to raise kids. I don't know. I get very confused when I take a look at people who choose to be victims. And there's a challenge. It's a real challenge.
Let's get into that just now. Yeah, that'll be a worthwhile discussion too, because I've had it up to here. And I'm like, you heard my rant about Joy Reid earlier.
Oh, yeah.
Again, people who, the minute they reach any point where they have to acquit themselves and it's difficult and you have to be accountable for something, they go straight into victim.
Yeah.
They're like, where? Poor me. So it's going to happen. We'll have that discussion in a little bit. John Wick is a role model for some kids, says Viasen. My favorite role models are all the cheese ones. Tasty, and it's easy to shape the cheese. My favorite role model is among the martyrs of the Orthodox Church, says Dave. Okay.
Wow.
Very good. And Caleb's here. You can't leave the cripples behind. We hobble in strong. Always looking for attention.
Yeah,
there's one leg, you know?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
It's unbelievable what some people, they'll get attacked by sharks just to be able to come in and comment on the show like
absolutely.
This. Absolutely.
How rude. Come on.
Unbelievable. Really, you let yourself down there, dude. Okay, we'll be back in just a moment or two. Justin's with us. We'll also find out about Abraham Lincoln. Okay, I kid you not. That's a real thing. The world's favorite new politician might not be a human. And I'm just saying maybe it's worth giving this a second thought. I know that immediately you go, but if we're ruled by the machines and you see a future with Terminator in it, but actually, what if artificial intelligence, which is not like a monster that's creeping around with a gun, and we also have to talk about guns just now, but it's also perhaps just the best way to allocate resources, best way to manage expenditure, to manage waste, to cut down on inefficiencies. I mean, we know AI can do all of that stuff. We've got a semi-machine guy doing it in America at the moment. I mean, Elon, isn't he half machine? We'll find out in a short while. All of that and more on the way.